Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 119 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, in the first of a two-part interview, poet and playwright Ian McMillan entertains Jeff Hattersley with a look at the world through Barnsley glasses, featuring rubber jam tarts, a novelty Coronation Street alarm clock, and a very, very strange game of chess.
Ian McMillan is a rare type of poet in that he almost needs no introduction. He's well known for his work as a presenter on Radio 3's The Verb and for a whole range of television programmes. First and foremost, however, he's one of the most original poets writing today. He's also an inspirational workshop tutor. I first met him in 1983 at a writer's workshop he was running in the area we both grew up in. He was the first person to encourage me to write poetry and also introduced me to the work of a number of poets who have continued to be a source of inspiration to me. I know lots of other poets who would also say this of Ian. I spoke to him at his home in Darfield, South Yorkshire. I'd like to start by asking you about something you said in your book, Perfect Catch. You wrote a series of 12 poems based on a trip to Mexico that said in an introduction to them that you'd tried to link Mexico and Barnsley, as Barnsley is the filter I see everything through. I love that phrase, but I wondered if you could expand on exactly what you mean by that.
Well, I think I did pinch that phrase from Roy Fisher, the great Roy Fisher, who said, Birmingham's what I think with. And I'm the same. Barnsley's what I think with. Because I've always lived here, you know, I've always lived in Darfield. And so Barnsley is the prism that I see everything through, because everywhere I go, everything I do is kind of refracted through the way we think round here, the way we talk round here, the way we react to things round here. The fact that I'm quite short, like a lot of people are around here, because they work down Pitt. My dad didn't work down Pitt, but I think I've kind of adapted to the area. I think you think in short vowels, you think in short sentences, you think in a kind of oppositional way. You're brussing, to use that fantastic Barnsley phrase, so you disagree with a lot of things. And that's what it is. So wherever I go, I think, how is this like Darfield? How is that like Gorba? How is that like Dodderth? And it's always been my ambition, always, like you, I think, Jeff, to get the universal in the local, you know, so you can write about Low Valley and you're writing about anywhere. And when I went to Mexico all those years ago, it was with a bloke from Thurnscoe called Dave Beresford, who was this film director and a tele director and artist. And we both, as we're going through Oaxaca, a brass band came out and started playing at Main Square. And you think, God, and he says, this could be Barnsley. So it is, that's what I do. I think wherever you're from, you think like that. I always link it to people like Norman Nicholson, who never moved far out of Milham in Cumbria, and Milham were what he saw the world through, and George Mackay Brown, who never moved far out of Orkneys, and saw everything through that angle. And you think, well, that's what you do, that's what I do as a writer. Some writers can be the opposite, and some writers can move all over the world, and everywhere they go, they'll take something else, and they won't have any particular base. But for me, it's always got to be Barnsley and Darfield, and for the last 30-odd years, this house. I was thinking the other day, I was washing up and I was looking out at the kitchen window and I thought, I've looked at this view for 30-odd years and it's changed a bit. But so that's it, that's the angle, that's what I see. And I sometimes think, we almost moved to Sheffield. When I was a lad, my dad was working in an office in Sheffield, and commuting every day in car, and we talked about moving closer. And wouldn't that have been interesting? If I'd lived somewhere else, I wouldn't have been this person. I might still have been a writer. Interesting, I don't know.
I'd like to talk about what I almost think of as your second coming as a poet. Not that you ever went away, and I'm probably simplifying things, but you seem to publish very little new work for quite a few years.
Yeah.
And suddenly in 2011 you brought out the first of three substantial pamphlets in quick succession with Mr. Off Top Books. So was there any particular thing that kick-started all that work?
It's funny, you're right, I hadn't written many poems for a few years. What had happened was I'd got busy writing other things. I'd been writing a lot of plays, and I'd been writing a lot of words for music, and I'd been writing a lot of journalism And it felt like the poems had just gone away. And I remember C.H. Sisson saying he stopped writing poems about 20 years. And I said to him at the time, I was a young man at the time, and I said, did it worry you? He said, no, because I knew it would come back. It never worried me. I thought, it will come back. There's no point trying to force it. It'll come back. Or it might not come back, but you don't need to try and force it. And then suddenly, in about 2010, these things started coming back. Poems started appearing. It was interesting. I didn't know why. I wasn't sure why. My grandson had been born in 2004, and I think that led to me, you start rethinking stuff. I think that helped. I think my son Andrew had started writing poems, and you think, well, I can't let him get away with it, as it were. And then you suddenly started writing stuff. And also, I think it's to do with the 2010 onwards, you got mostly Conservative government back in power. And I think a lot of stuff I wrote in the 80s were about the Conservatives and the feeling round here, what happened. And then from 97 to 2010, it got a bit better round here. And also you're busy bringing up a family and you're busy with all sorts of things. And maybe you do need a bit of space in your head. So the first one was called This Lake Used to Be Frozen Lamps, which yeah. just came to me out of blue, this title. Because I thought, so I'm a big one for just writing stuff down when it occurs to me, to put it down. And I thought, what I like about it is the colon. This lake used to be frozen lamps, you know, this colon. And at the time I thought that colon's like, it's like a lamp. It's like a moon over a lake, reflected. I love the visual thing of that colon. And it's the idea that for a while the lake's been frozen. It's been totally frozen because the poems aren't coming out because I'm writing different things. And then suddenly there's this lamp. This lamp's appeared and I'm able to write stuff again. And it was an interesting thing and they kind of poured out of me. Well, partly because Peter and Anne Sansom had said to them, if I did a pamphlet, would you want to publish it? And they said, yeah. And that excited me. So then I'd just keep sending them stuff. And it was like a floodgate kind of opened. And what it was just walking round Womwell and Darfield and same old places and seeing people and thinking, not that much has changed, but a lot's changed, you know. And it was an amazing moments writing these poems, thinking, God, it's not, things haven't changed. The other thing that got me going was a chap called Ian Nichols, who was an artist. He's from Darfield. He'd been to art college in London and Chelsea Art School and made a living as an artist in London. Mum and dad lived in Darfield, still do. His dad had a stroke, so Ian came back up to look after him. And I walked out in the middle of Darfield and he cycled past me and went, you're Ian McMillan? I said, yeah. And he was interesting because he saw Darfield as an outsider. And we started collaborating on stuff. It was interesting. So he got me going as well. So it was just partly that, I suppose it was that. It really was. It was interesting and exciting. I'll read you a couple out of This Lake Used to Be Frozen Lamps. The first one in the book is called It's Only a Novelty Coronation Street Alarm Clock. And this is just a transcription of something that happened at Womwell. Me and my wife and my mother-in-law on Fridays go up Womwell for what my wife calls a few bits. And we just heard a fella coming out of the shop and he was cross and he says to his wife, look, it's only a novelty Coronation Street alarm clock. I thought, where have I been all these years? Just write it down. Just write down what they say. And then he says, you're going to go back in shop and buy this novelty Coronation Street alarm clock. And then his wife says, have you got the ham? Oh, he's going to get some ham and a novelty Coronation Street alarm clock. And then, so I just wrote it. And then one of my favourite moments in Coronation Street, which I don't watch anymore, is when Martha Longhurst died in Snug. And Peter Adamson, as Len Fairclough, had to do this bit of acting. And he had to go, she's dead! And his voice had to go, she's dead! Like that. And he came out with this amazing moment where he couldn't really act. And Martha Longhurst dead in Snug, and he comes out, she's dead! So I just put it all in. So it's called It's Only a Novelty Coronation Street Alarm Clock. Put it in with a ham then. Shall we get some nails for you to hang it up, crucify it like Christ? And then, in the evening, we'll take it down and put it in a cupboard and we'll eat the ham. At the weekend, it will rise out of the cupboard, hang itself back up on the wall. A miracle, I call it, like Martha Longhurst, back from the Snug with wings. If I were writing this poem again now, I would make that ending a bit less resonant. I think it's a bit resonant. You know, when people write poems, endings are so important, and I wanted this poem kind of to slip away. But at the end, I've gone, no, no, Martha Longhurst, you know, so I would alter it. So that was real, and I put it in the book first because it just, it got me going, that poem. And then it just, and it just reminded me, I thought, I can just write down. I can write down what these amazing people who live around here say. And so this other one, which I'll read from this pamphlet, was this fella, who, because I'm quite well known, people often stop me and talk to me, which is fine, I like it. And they'll often give me poems or they'll tell me things. And I saw this fella on Barnsley Station, and he came up to me and went, I found my dad. And then it just went on like this, and it was just Platform 2 on Barnsley Station. So it's called Platform 2. We're both waiting, and he comes over to me. His cap is dark. I found my dad, he says, as though he knows me. Good, I said, that's good. His cap is dark. At Stairbottomian, he hung his sen. His cap is dark. He must have been lawyering to do that, does that think? His cap is dark. I always get a return ticket just in case. His cap. You know the rest. And the reason I put the his cap bit was just, he had this black flat cap on. And it like, and my eyes were drawn to this cap. And just the amazing bit when he went, found me dad, hung his sen. And then later on, after I'd written the poem, I bumped into somebody who said, oh, I know him. He once came round to my house and says, has they got any shoes? So I says to him, how big does they want them? And he said, out above an 8. So you think, well, what I always say is, why make out up? Why? You know this. Why? Just walk down the street and it just showers in on you. And once I'd written, this lake used to be frozen lamps, then it really was. The floodgates opened and I started writing things. And by this time, I mean, I'm 59 now, 60 next year. I was in my mid-50s, late-50s. And it's a time you think you'll never get to. You think, I'm never going to be that old. When my dad was in his 50s, he was ancient. When his granddad's in the 50s, they're really old. I felt all right. I didn't feel poorly. But I started writing things about round here, about the people I remembered from my childhood. They seem to pop in. And so I'll read a poem about my Uncle Charlie, playing chess with Uncle Charlie, who's related to you, Jeff, of course.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah. And Uncle Charlie were that, what they call an autodidact. He couldn't read or write, but he learnt a lot of stuff off telly. And his big thing was, he'd always said to you, them Tories here, the lower than vermin. That's Nye Bevan's old phrase. And he'd come up with it. When he'd come up with it, like, inappropriately, at any point, he's watching Songs of Praise, and he'd go, them Tories, lower than vermin. And in this poem, I used to like to play chess with him. Because he couldn't read or write, he never bothered to learn rules, so he just played it however he wanted. And this takes place on this kind of terrible afternoon where my auntie, we didn't, she was called Gladys, just called her auntie. We were sat playing chess. Auntie had drunk some bleach out of a bottle because, like a fool, she put bleach in this old lemonade bottle. And so, it's called Playing Chess with Uncle Charlie. Well, for a start, he called it chest. And he said that any piece could move in any direction and take any other piece in any way it wanted to, including flicking them off the board or wrapping them in a rubber band. He changed from black to white on a whim and won. And once he made a hill of sugar on the corner square for that castle thing to hide behind, he said, his eyes big behind those glasses that magnified so much for so long with such love. Once we were playing in the back room, he just substituted a part jive for a pawn. He was singing along to sing something simple, so it must have been Sunday. And in the kitchen, unknown to us, my auntie had just glugged from a bleach bottle, thinking it was lemonade. He was holding forth, continuing my political education. Bevan got it right, Ian. Lower than vermin. That's what they are, Tories. Lower than vermin. And he put me king in his waistcoat pocket and said, check it him eight, Ian. Check it him eight. In the kitchen, my auntie was gasping for breath. Uncle Charlie couldn't read or write. Left school too soon, straight down the pit. I once tried to teach him, but me Janet and John embarrassed us both, so we got the chessboard out and never mentioned it again. He put a hat on the bishop, made from an eggshell. And that's all true. And I wish I put in the poem, but I later put in a prose thing, was we go in the kitchen and my auntie, she's gasping for breath, but at the same time, she's buttering some bread. And he says, what's that drunk that bleeds for? And she says, it's all right, it's good country. It's all right, it's all right. She says, it was diluted. God, you just gotta write it down, don't you? You just gotta write it down. My Uncle Jack lived in Hillsborough. He were a proper, what we call a D-Down. Ah, didn't he? Ah, didn't he? Had that D-Down, proper D-Down accent. And every Boxing Day, we go to his house. And every Boxing Day, he'd get these rubber jam tarts out that he bought for a joke. And he had to pretend, you couldn't remember he'd got them out Boxing Day before. So he went, don't want a tart after the tea. You have to go, hey up, Jack, these tarts are a bit rubbery than us. And then you knew, it was like a signal, that's when my mama got a coat on. We go home and he liked we had rubber tarts. And so I thought, I'll try and write a poem in a sort of postmodern knowing way, where the idea is that I'm trying to write the poem fast enough so that he ain't got time to get rubber tarts out before I get to end the poem, which is daft, but it seems to work. And then it's about what most of my poems these days are about, language and politics, and about the politics of language, because I still, after all these years on radio, get people taking the mickey out of my accent, get people writing to me, get people saying, you can't talk like that on radio. You get a lot of that. The professional Yorkshireman thing, people, you know, say, I put this voice on, you know, they're at home, I talk like Prince Charles. And my reply is that they're at home, he talks like me. And this is about something that happened with me, Uncle Jack in war. It's called Uncle Jack's Rubber Tarts, Boxing Day, 1964. Better get the poem written quickly before the rubber tarts come out. We've had tea. We're just having a bun or a tart before we go home from Marcliffe Road. Uncle Jack is talking about when he saw the American General Mark Clark driving the wrong way away from the fighting back in 42 or 43. He can't remember or won't which year. I says to him, Nardin, General Mark Clark, fighting's that way than us. They're going the wrong way for fighting. The Sheffield A's make the name Mark Clark ring like a bell. Hurry up, tarts will be out soon. Ah, I flirted with Communist Party. We all did. Nardin, would you like a tart before you go? Too late. Rubber tarts are out. Bite them. Outside, snow falls like a reminder that language is always going to be the battleground. The fighting's that way, you know. Because this American general comes past, now the fighting's that way. I do find that funny. Oh, dear. And the other one, philosophical inquiry. Yes, the language of philosophical inquiry. I always like a nice resonant title, Jeff. I like a title that kind of, you know, like that.
Yeah, well, you certainly come up with them.
I do, I like them. I think I sometimes borrow them from popular song or you borrow them from learned tomes. And I think it's nice to, because you know, that sometimes a title can tell you too much. You know, My Funeral, you know, or something like that. Or like, where they go the other way, Untitled Six. You know, and I'd rather just make the title an extra line. Or sometimes that thing that Simon Amis is used to do where or other poets do it, you know, where the title's the first line of the poem. I like that. That can kind of lead you in. And who was it the other day? I was reading somebody, and they put the title at the end, a Dutch poet.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, you read the poem, then the title is there at the end, and that stops you thinking too hard about the poem from the title. So that's an interesting way of doing it. And this is just that thing where people say the word absolutely a lot. They say the word to be fair a lot. They say the word sort of a lot. They say the word round here. They say that fantastic thing where they go, something daft like that. And they apply it to anything. They go, I went to the shop or something daft like that. And to me, it's expanded. They go, I went to the shop or something like that. I went to the shop or something daft like that. And you think, they're only going to the shop. So this is just, that's what this poem's about, really. And it goes fairly quickly, this poem, I think. The language of philosophical inquiry. To be fair, you know, it's like that old sort of saying, if an electric toothbrush falls over in an empty bathroom, is there a sound? Sort of the idea of the toothbrush, you know, clipping the sink before it hits the floor. But if you're not there, if you're, I don't know, up in the loft or something daft like that, sorting out your old Green Lantern comics, cataloguing in a manner of speaking, is there, noise? Any happening then? Tap on, lav flush, light string click, bee banging into the sort of window, system filling, pipes, you know, kind of bumping and nobody's there, like, is there a noise sort of thing? Trumping doesn't count, don't be stupid. Somebody's got to be there for a sort of trumping noise. But to be fair, if the bathroom's empty and the sort of noise kind of happens, is there a noise? Have you got any nail rack of borrow? A blue one? Yeah, brown one would be fine, absolutely. Because that word absolutely, I'm fascinated by it. Because it's overtaken yes, isn't it? You go, is it 10 to 3? Absolutely. And it's interesting. And people say, you know, I think you should celebrate them. I don't mind them at all. I really don't mind them. Today on Twitter, somebody put, he was in the throes of adolescence, spelt like you're throwing a ball, T-R-T-R-O. Yeah, yeah. And I thought, what a fantastic thing, because when you're adolescent, yeah, you've been thrown about. So I retweeted it and said, oh, I didn't mean to put that. And I put, forget it, celebrate it. You know, I get that cross, so cross with people who think they're clever because they know where apostrophe goes in tomatoes. That gets me so cross. And I go, look, get a life. It really gets people going on Twitter. You just put the grammar police. They're there, they're everywhere. They're self-appointed, you know. They say, you're a lesser human being because you don't know where the apostrophe goes. And you think, yeah, but people feel bad because of that, don't they? They think, oh, I'm not clever. Because you think, and the apostrophe is going to go. Michael Rosen, the other day on the radio, was talking about it, and he says, give it 50 years, it'll have gone. And nobody'll mourn it's passing, I don't think.
That was Ian McMillan in conversation with Jeff Hattersley. You'll be able to hear the second part of this interview in the forthcoming episode 123. You can find out more about Ian on his website at www.uktouring.org.uk/Ian-Macmillan/. That's Macmillan spelt MC. And that concludes episode 119, which was recorded by Jeff Hattersley and produced by Conor McPhee. We'd like to thank Smith Doorstop Books for permission to use Ian's poems. Coming up in episode 120, poet and non-fiction writer Kathleen Jones tells Frances Burns about the mythic relationship between people and their landscapes in her writing, be it a disturbing poem set in her now-abandoned childhood Cumbrian Fell home, or fierce non-fiction about the former British Columbian Islands. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.